Okay, let's do that again. Call this meeting of the Commerce Committee in order now that the microphones are on. Our first, we do have a quorum. The first item on the agenda is approval of our minutes from March 11th, 2024. Representative Katiza Watoon.
Mr. Chair, I would move approval of the March 11th minutes.
Representative Katiza Watoon moves approval of our minutes from March 11th, 2024. Any discussion to the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. The first item on our agenda today is House File 4745 from the Majority Leader, who's coming on down. I will move House File 4745 be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. I will also move the A3 amendment, which I assume gets the bill in the shape you'd like us to consider it.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any discussion to the A3? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails and the A3 is adopted. Representative Wong, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Too many Minnesotans still don't have access to affordable quality health coverage. Average deductibles for Medicare bronze plans are around $7,000, and half of those who are on the individual market choose these plans. Deductibles drive healthcare choices, and a $7,000, $8,000, or $10,000 deductible means avoided care and bad health outcomes. Minnesota Care has been a hugely successful public health care program for low-income working individuals since 1992. The Minnesota Care public option bill that we're hearing today would increase health care coverage and affordability by giving more Minnesotans the option to choose the simple, comprehensive, trusted coverage of Minnesota Care. Last year, we took an important step forward, authorizing the Department of Commerce and Human Services to commission an actuarial analysis on a Minnesota Care public option. The study, conducted by the respected actuarial firm Milliman, shows that a Minnesota Care public option could help more than 100,000 Minnesotans reduce health care costs and improve access to care. The bill is based on Model 1D from the Milliman study, which assumes Medicare rates and limits on public subsidies for those earning more than 400% of the federal poverty line, or around $100,000 for a family of four. The Milliman study also shows that Minnesota Care would reduce the uninsured population in Minnesota by up to 32,000 people in the projection for Model 1D. This will, of course, lead to reductions in uncompensated care as well as the health benefits from those folks being insured. The bill allows those who don't have access to affordable employer-based health care to purchase Minnesota Care at a sliding premium scale from a low of just under 5% of household income to a high of 10%. We also lay out additional cost sharing that increases up the income scale, including adding copays above 400% of federal poverty line. We set out enrollment limits in the first two plan years to try to smooth the transition to the Minnesota Care public option. We're currently working with the administration on a final model based on the bill as introduced, which we believe will reduce the costs even further from the models that were in the report. Minnesota Care was a national model when it was enacted. Our Minnesota congressional delegation fought during the Affordable Care Act debate to protect it, and it has served us well as a federally approved basic health plan. This gives us a unique opportunity as a state to build on the success of Minnesota Care and to pass the best public option in the country. We must work towards ensuring everyone in our state can have affordable health care choices, and this bill will be a nation-leading step in that direction. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We'll now move to testimony. And just for everyone in the audience who's planning to testify today on any bill, we have a very, very full agenda today. So we're going to ask everyone to limit their testimony to 2 minutes. We'll be keeping time. And I will have to ask you to conclude your remarks if you go over 2 minutes. I will interject. I'm sorry for that, but we're really tight today. I'm also going to ask people to come down two at a time, and then that way we can just go very quickly between testifiers. So the first testifier is Megan Paul, who will be followed by Dan Andreessen. So if you both could come down, and then Ms. Paul, if you would just state your name for your record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Megan Paul. I've been chronically ill all of my life, with it worsening since I've become an adult. This requires many doctor's appointments, hospital visits, medications. In the last 5 years, I've accumulated over $70,000 of medical debt that is sitting in collections because insurance is not covering these services, and I'm not able to pay that up front. In 2021, I qualified for Minnesota Care. It was the best health insurance I'd ever received. My chronic conditions were able to be well managed because I could access the care that I needed, which kept me out of the hospital. However, last year my projected income changed due to an hourly raise, so I no longer qualified for Minnesota Care. However, my hours are not guaranteed at work, so I can't afford my current health insurance premium for insurance that doesn't even cover many of the doctors that I was seeing under Minnesota Care. My health has worsened again, which has put me in and out of the ER since the beginning of this year. I am not able to work as much due to this, which has led me to need community assistance for things like rent, utilities, and my health insurance premium. The public option would help me be able to better manage my health, which would keep me out of the hospital for longer periods of time. I wouldn't have to make the regular decision between seeking health care and going into debt or being able to pay for rent and groceries. Having a public option would mean paying for a reasonable price and having access to the excellent health care that I had when I was on Minnesota Care, which would relieve so many of the current burdens and barriers I am facing. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next is Dan Andreessen, who will be followed by Angela Knutson. So, Ms. Knutson, if you could come down and have a seat, and Mr. Andreessen, proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. We understand the challenges of health care affordability. Our members want to be constructive in finding solutions, but the establishment of a public option is something we're very concerned about. Last session, we testified that there are several questions that need to be answered before proceeding. We're still waiting for some of those answers, such as what are going to be impacts of the commercial market, including projected stability of the individual group markets, and what will be the response of providers, and how will reimbursement rates impact enrollee access to care if providers favor commercially insured products because Minnesota care rates are too low. As we debate this topic, let's come back to what problem are we trying to solve and how quickly can we enact a solution. We've heard today, or we're going to hear, that concerns about insurance premiums and out-of-pocket costs, and that the solution being proposed today is increasing subsidization of those costs through open access to a Minnesota Care program. If the legislature is open to subsidization, there is a much simpler solution: to subsidize a product on the exchange to mirror Minnesota Care's 94% actuarial value. The council worked with RAND this summer to model the approach and is a possible solution. It would be a platinum-level product, so cost sharing would be low. Typically, this means a higher premium, but that could be offset by state-funded premium subsidies. This plan would be open to anyone. It could target subsidies based on certain income levels, similar to other subsidies, and we can help move people out of the bronze level that shouldn't be there. This is something the state could implement much faster than a public option, would not cause provider payment shifts, and could be done in a more cost-effective way compared to a public option. Timing of this decision is important given the simultaneous expiration of the federal ARPA subsidies and state funding for reinsurance, which is projected to impact 87,000 people in the individual market. The council has historically worked closely with policymakers to find solutions, and we look forward to working with the author. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Angela Knutson, who will be followed by Bentley Graves.
Chair and members of the committee, my name is Angela Knutson, and I'm a nurse at Health Partners and a member of SEIU Healthcare Minnesota and Iowa, the healthcare union of 50,000 workers across the state, and we proudly support this bill. Too often, caregivers like me see the reality of our patients delaying or skipping necessary medical care because they cannot afford the high out-of-pocket expenses. We constantly have people with serious health issues who should really come in so we can diagnose, treat the issue. They say they can't or they won't because of the high costs. We've all heard the same comments. I can't afford the copay. My deductible is too high. In one of the richest states, in the richest country in the world, this should not be a common occurrence. We can and must do better. The reality is that patients with Minnesota Care don't face this terrible choice. And if we pass this bill, it would help expand who can utilize Minnesota Care. I'm not just here as a caregiver. I once found myself in a similar situation as some of my patients, a job that didn't offer benefits. I didn't qualify for Minnesota Care because I was over the income threshold, but I also didn't make enough to afford private health insurance. An affordable public health, public option to buy into MinCare would have been a great solution, and I wouldn't have had to make decisions like so many others of which medical issues were worth treating and incurring a huge bill over, and which ones would just have to wait and I would have to suffer through. A true Minnesota Care public option would mean residents across our state could sleep a little easier, knowing that they and their families would have access to quality, affordable health insurance. I ask you all to vote yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Bentley Graves, who will be followed by Stephanie Whitehorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Bentley Graves with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The majority of Minnesotans, roughly 60%, access health insurance coverage through their employer. These and other Minnesotans in the commercial market pay doctors and hospitals more than twice as much as Minnesota Care Program pays these providers today. For better or worse, these higher payments ensure healthcare providers have the resources needed to pay staff, operate and maintain facilities, expand service offerings, and invest in new treatments, procedures, and devices to improve the health of the Minnesotans they serve. For better or worse, these higher payments drive Minnesota's accessible and quality healthcare ecosystem. But House File 4745 raises significant concerns about the impact a public option could have on that ecosystem. In its first year, it's estimated the public option would cover 107,000 people, 70% of whom are expected to move to it from private coverage in the individual market, which pays doctors and hospitals at a rate at the commercial rate. The effect of the public option then would be to reduce by half the amount doctors and hospitals are paid to care for these new public option enrollees. Already, 67% of Minnesota hospitals have negative operating margins, and yet costs from labor to supplies are rising. Under public option, with a growing number of patients walking through their doors paying less than what it costs to deliver care, how will they continue to do all the things that they do today? Will doctors and hospitals be forced to pull back on the services they currently offer? Will they make up the lost revenue by charging those with private insurance even more? We have other questions as well. Among them, why does this plan assume that none of the roughly 60% of Minnesotans who currently offer coverage or have coverage to their employer will transition to the public option? Why are we considering a plan for a public option that assumes those in this majority of the public won't consider this option? What if they did? More lives covered means the state cost would increase, wouldn't it? Especially for this population, since there would be no subsidy from the federal pass-through funds? And if we did see a shift in coverage like this, wouldn't that exacerbate the access and cross-subsidization issues from doctors and hospitals' payments being cut in half and increasing for increasing number of their patients? The cost of healthcare is too high. Minnesota families all in healthcare spending is already third highest in the country. But trying to fix this by arbitrarily slashing payments to providers invites a host of potentially harmful unintended consequences related to Minnesotans' access to care and the cost paid by the majority of Minnesotans. These have long been our concerns about a public option like this, and they remain unchanged today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Next, we have Stephanie Whitehorn, who will be followed by Mary Krinke. Ms. Whitehorn.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Whitehorn, and I am a small business owner out of Rochester, Minnesota, along with my husband, Bud. I'm a mother of eight. I have six sons and two daughters, seven adults of varying incomes, all the way from a police officer, soon to be detective, down to a welder. My grandmother of five. I have one grandson who is low-functioning autistic. I've navigated several health issues, including my own being diagnosed with a chronic autoimmune disease, which has recently come out of remission. I've diagnosed the mental health as department, as well as I have a daughter who is a high-functioning autistic child. I have a husband who at a young age was in need of a total knee replacement. I've even navigated the hospice care system on multiple times. I currently qualify for Minnesota Care due to my income and household size. But what happens if my business starts to make more money? What happens when my youngest daughter ages out? That can put my husband and I one major medical issue away from total bankruptcy, personally and for our business. We cannot afford, unfortunately, to offer our employees health care at this time due to the cost. In addition, we cannot give them both a living wage and health care. Offering living wage would often make it so that many people would not qualify for Minnesota Care. So many people are going without insurance in lieu of having food and toiletries. I actually have a friend who had to divorce her husband so that they were able to qualify with a child. These things just shouldn't be happening. People should not be choosing and taking medications not as prescribed because there's a fear of running out of them. Unfortunately, everyone, I believe that our current system favors dollars over quality care, greed over compassion, and expanding Minnesota Care to over 100,000 Minnesotans, which someday could be very well one of you, moves us to a healthier Minnesota that values health over wealth. And we will have to make a choice because no man can serve two masters. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Mary Krinke, who will be followed by Luke Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for the record, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. The underlying goals of a public option program are to attempt to make health insurance more affordable and that this program should be available to everyone regardless of their income. The public option is made in part more affordable because it's premised on paying health care providers below the current amounts of commercial payment rates. We urge lawmakers to pause and take time to address several of the three key issues. And without doing this, I'm fearful that we could destroy a very good healthcare system here in Minnesota. Number one, address the full cost of it creating, administering, and providing the necessary technology support of this new government program. Number two, use realistic estimates of how many individuals would move from the private market and into the public option. The current report estimates that number to be non-existent. And number three, address the issue of provider payment rates. How much should providers get paid? Given that two-thirds of the hospitals and health care systems are currently operating with a negative margin, and Medicaid currently pays providers about 70 cents on every dollar of 2019 costs, clearly hospitals are understandably worried about this. Under the public option, it is estimated that hospitals would see an annual loss in revenues of about $203 million. The language in the bill says Medicare payments or greater. That is a very big window and a very important to better define. We need some clarity on what those payment rates would be. This could have a big impact, negative impact on access to care, particularly in rural Minnesota, as services might need to be eliminated and potentially even hospital closures. There are more efficient ways to cover low-income and middle-class and middle-income individuals, and we would urge you look at some of those alternatives before running into this option. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Next, we will have Luke Sanders, who will be followed by Mike Anderson. Mr. Sanders.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Luke Sanders. I farm near Kirkhove, Minnesota, and a member of Minnesota Farmers Union. Again, on behalf of myself and Minnesota Farmers Union, I'm glad to share my strong support of Representative Long's bill to establish a Minnesota Care public option. Again, this year, we met for our annual convention. We identified the affordable costs of health care as a top priority. Too many farm families are being priced out of coverage or are being forced to work off the farm to afford insurance. This limits our real economy and makes it harder for young people to ensure their dreams in agriculture. My family story is just one example of that. I farm with my wife, Hannah. We have one son that is 18 months old, had twin boys that were born prematurely and passed away. My wife and I farm with our parents, Harmon and Gina, and my wife's two other sisters. We raise corn, beans, sugar beets, and I'm working to grow our beef cows that we're direct marketing called Wilts Cattle Company. Hannah teaches ag and education in Wilmer, and I love to transition back into our farming operation full time. I would love that too. But we've got a young kid and we're going to have another baby boy in a month or less. We can't afford to carry health insurance. Currently, I pay a lot for insurance with a deductible of $8,000 and a monthly premium of $330. Because I feel I need to be covered, it feels unreasonable because I'm paying a lot. Then, also pretty much paying for every appointment and medical thing that I do since I do never reach my deductible. My wife's insurance is through her work, but if she wants to be on the farm full time, health insurance is one of the things that is standing in the way of her doing that, especially with trying to raise a family and continuing to have more kids. It might be small, but multiplied across the many families like mine, I believe this has a big impact. It's about people's opportunity to build the life that they want to live. And if we want young families on the land, rural schools are full of kids, and thriving communities, we need to figure out health care. And for Minnesota Farmers Union, we believe strongly that this is the next step of making affordable coverage available to every Minnesotan. Thank you to the leader, Long, and 35 co-authors for your hard work on this proposal. It matters to families like mine. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Congratulations on your child. That's exciting. Next, Mike Anderson, who will be followed by Sarah Abadi. Excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Mike Anderson. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters, the trade group representing health and benefit agents. While the main goal of this bill is to provide more competition for insurance carriers, we feel it fails to do so and will have several unintended consequences that are not being considered. Competition is great, but Minnesotans appreciate a level playing field, and this bill in no way provides for fair competition. It's not hard to see how premiums will be a fraction of premiums of commercial carriers when the public option cuts payments to the hospitals and clinics in half and pays none of the taxes that the commercial plans pay. In the individual market, the artificially lower premiums will shift costs to commercial plans. In addition, these subsidies and subsidized limits on cost sharing will be the death blow to the individual market and lead carriers to withdraw, similar to the crisis in 2017. In the small group market, since there's no requirement that small groups offer coverage, many employers will discontinue their small group plan and send them to MinSure to buy the public option. This will not only erode the small group market, but it will shift future premium increases to the employee. Also, group plans are required to maintain a minimum percentage of participation to keep their group policies in place. Employers who don't participate because they move to the individual plans or the public option count against that participation rate. So if enough employees in a group move to the public option, their employer will be disqualified from offering a group plan, further eroding the commercial market and leaving their fellow employees without their employer's premium contribution. Another likely outcome is that our clients will have trouble getting appointments with providers if they choose the public option plan. Providers will know that they will be underpaid and will prioritize private plan patients for a few open slots, creating a two-tiered system. Please vote no.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Sarah Abadi, who will be followed by Michelle Benson.
Hi, my name is Sarah Abadi. I'm the leader of Uno Dos Minnesota. Thank you for the members of the commerce community and Chair Stephenson for giving me the opportunity to speak before you today. I work at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, which is one of the largest, most profitable, and prestigious hospitals in the country. As an employee at the Mayo Clinic, I can see how my coworkers are a part of a huge machine, yet they're unable to pay for health care they need. When I was younger, I was diagnosed with cancer. At the time, I was covered through the state insurance here in Minnesota. I'm grateful because that allowed me to get the treatment, and thus I am here with you all today. Many of my peers don't have the same opportunity because they make just barely over the income limit. A close friend of mine who had just started working at Mayo had gotten severely sick while at work and was told to go to the ER before returning. But since her insurance had yet to kick in, she was told she had options for charity care, but was denied due to her income level. I can't seem to comprehend how, as an employee at one of the finest healthcare systems in the world and living in a state that has shown to be with and for the people, we're still okay with not providing excellent, accessible healthcare for all Minnesotans. I'm asking you today to please support the public option proposal because it will help Minnesotans, especially those who are completely locked out of having options by our current system to access care. The implementation of this will save lives. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next, we have Michelle Benson, who will be followed by Abby Loesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Leader Long, and committee members. I'm Michelle Benson with the Health Plan Partnership of Minnesota. There's no panacea in healthcare. House File 4745 will upend Minnesota's healthcare ecosystem with the expansion of government payer rates having a significant impact on access and quality. There will also be significant impacts on existing insurance markets. This bill will likely erode and then sunset the individual health insurance market. The public option will probably diminish the small group employer market as small business owners opt for ICHRA coverage for their employees. Cost shifting in healthcare systems will raise costs for employers and for union negotiated coverage. Even at Medicare rates, cost shifting will be significant. Many of our hospitals are already financially strained. So how will lower payments improve the long-term stability of a strained healthcare system? To remain viable, healthcare systems will cut expenses, including wages. Nursing homes, as you know, have a large government payer mix and historically have lower wages for RNs than hospital systems. Rural health systems with more limited access to commercial payers will have increasing difficulty competing for doctors, nurses, and other providers because they will simply have less money available to pay competitive compensation. How will this bill attract more talent to our care systems? How will paying care systems less improve hospital viability? Additionally, once again, we will be relying on a rapidly implemented single source IT program at MinSure. Who remembers the last time we did this? Because I do. It was expensive and it didn't work very well. For many reasons, The Health Plan Partnership of Minnesota opposes House File 4745. It will destabilize our fragile healthcare ecosystem and ultimately reduce access and quality of healthcare to Minnesotans, increasing costs across the entire care delivery system. Thank you, members. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Next, we have Abby Loesch, who will be followed by Rihanna Lee. Ms. Loesch.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Abby Loesch, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Business Partnership, which represents many of Minnesota's largest employers, employing almost 500,000 workers across the state. Minnesota ranks near the top in the nation for healthcare coverage, and we are grateful to our many world-class healthcare providers headquartered here in Minnesota. Healthcare affordability, access, and equity are vitally important to our members, and I want to express some of our concerns regarding House File 4745. While we share the goal of affordable and accessible healthcare, this bill is not the way to improve the state's healthcare system. This proposal will increase cost shifting onto commercial policyholders in both the self and fully insured markets to compensate for lower government reimbursement rates. Consequently, higher healthcare expenses passed on to private insurers will inevitably result in increased rates for those enrolled in employer-sponsored health insurance programs. This bill could reduce access to healthcare and increase costs as the limitations of cost shifting are reached. With a growing public payer population, healthcare providers will face mounting challenges in offsetting lower reimbursement rates. This could force providers, especially those already operating on thin margins, to reduce services, particularly in rural and underserved areas. Despite being home to numerous world-class healthcare providers, this bill threatens to erode the industry's competitive edge and puts Minnesota at a disadvantage to attract global talent to our state, particularly amidst a workforce shortage. We currently have no way of knowing the full scope of consequences this could have for Minnesota's patients, providers, employers, and the taxpayers. We respectfully ask committee members to oppose this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And we have Rihanna Lee. Ms. Lee.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon. My name is Rihanna Lee, and I am the Legislative and Coalitions Director for Americans for Prosperity here in Minnesota. I did submit a letter that details robustly our opposition to House File 4745, along with a list of affordable solutions that we can take today. We are strongly opposed to the public option because of the failure that it has been in other states, the significant cost to taxpayers, and the decrease in care quality that is the direct result of government interference in healthcare. The public option has flopped in three states. There are vast issues with care, cost, quality, reduced access to care, and patient access. And studies actually show that most people are generally satisfied with their health care, and they are not looking for more government interference in their health care. That is not to say there is not room for strong reform, because we know there are. We also have significant concerns with the costs of the program. In Medicaid expansion states, actual costs have been double the amounts. One of the biggest contributors is the woodwork effect. People are going to be signing up for these benefits because they heard of a new program and migration from other plans. And private plans also significantly subsidize the public option and cost subscribers even more to make up for those drastically steep cuts imposed by government-run health care. And I'd like to just remind everybody that there's no such thing as anything being truly free. There are, however, several tried and proven ways that instead of expanding the scope of government, expands consumer choices. Examples include enacting safe harbor bills for direct primary care. I'd like to draw your attention to House File 3648, removing barriers to allow more physicians to practice in the state, and Representative Liebling's bill that will allow enrollees to opt out of managed care enrollment, which is House File 816. I did include a list of the solutions that we can take today in your packets, and while there are elements that need to be done at the federal level, we at the state level can certainly take action to help put patients in control of the care that they need. The public option is not the way. We do stand ready to help build strong bipartisan legislation that prioritizes freedom, transparency, and personal choice in health care. Thank you.
Thank you. We will now move to member discussion and questions. Discussion to the bill. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If Majority Leader Long could, oh, he's a returning, excellent, excellent. I'm going to ask like a series of questions in a couple of questions just so that we're not back and forth on this in the interest of time. Majority Leader Long, in your DEM or your A3 amendment, you have taken out
and deleted the premium subsidies that were in the bill, as well as changed some of the cost-sharing formulas and the tax credits. Can you explain how that makes the bill, makes this option more affordable for people when they don't have the tax credits, the premium subsidies, or the shift in cost-sharing?
Leader Long.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. Thank you for the question, Representative O'Driscoll. So those were for the gap year in 2026. The Minnesota Care public option would start in 2027. The gap year is an important conversation, but didn't feel like it needed to necessarily be part of this bill. Felt like it could be a separate conversation in the Health Committee.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one of the criticisms of Minnesota Care has been that in the fully insured market, that state mandates are included in coverage that a business may purchase and offer as a benefit for their employees. In Minnesota Care, we don't have those. What is your plan to try to or to deal with coverages that are not included in Minnesota Care when we're trying to provide a broader base of insurance for more Minnesotans?
Leader Law.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. Thank you for the question. I think that's an important discussion. I think that's a little beyond the scope of my bill. What I will say is that MnSure is very good coverage, as I think you heard from the people who were on it, and it does have very comprehensive benefits.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Again, I wasn't talking about MnSure. I was talking about Minnesota Care. I'm sorry if I misspoke.
I meant Minnesota Care.
Probably. Oh, I thought I might have misspoke. That could happen. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess my concern is that the biggest concern is that with any kind of public option that we have, if we continue to pay lower reimbursement rates for more people, where does that gap come from, and how do we fill the gap for the providers so they don't close their doors? Last year we had a robust conversation about Fairview and their financial demise and situation and trying to keep them afloat so that people who use Fairview are able to continue to use them. How does this bill, by paying lower reimbursement rates, keep places like Fairview and medical attention for persons?
Leader Long.
Thank you. Well, you only get reimbursed if the care is being used, and if you have a $8,000, $9,000, $10,000 deductible, people are avoiding care. So certainly people are going to be using care more if they have insurance that they can use. We also have a significant reduction in the uninsured population, and those are individuals that don't have health care now and so aren't getting any reimbursement if they're coming in, and those folks would be reimbursed at Medicare rates as well.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Final comment, Mr. Chair and Majority Leader Long. I think that we are better off by supporting the fully insured market, offering tax credits and other kinds of things to be able to have people get the broader base of coverage. At that testifying table that you were at last week, we had several people coming in and talking about coverages that will not be covered that they would like to see in the individual market. And I don't think that we help anyone or we could be building false hopes for people about what might be available in the coverage. And we have a lot of work to do on this, and members, I would recommend a no vote today, just given the fact that this bill does need a lot more work to actually be viable to be able to provide insurance. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, Leader Long, I personally want to thank you for your excellent work on this bill. It's an important bill. I think it's taking Minnesota in the right direction. What people want is the opportunity to have affordable health care, and this bill is important in that respect. And with that, I'll give you the opportunity to give closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the testifiers said it better than I could, which is that we have a broken health care system in our state, and we know that too many people are having really tragic health care outcomes every single day in this state because they can't access care. We know that Minnesota Care is an incredibly popular, successful program, and this would simply expand it to provide more access to more Minnesotans, which I think would save lives and provide important access to health care for 100,000 people.
All right. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 4745, as amended, be referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails, and House File 4745, as amended, is recommended to be referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Before we take up the next bill, I'm imagining that there's a number of people in the room who are about to stand up and leave, and that's totally fine. You're not obligated to stay. Please, please, please do it as quietly as you possibly can and save your conversations until you exit the room. We have a lot of bills on the agenda. Thank you for coming today, and thank you for your consideration as you leave. The next bill on our agenda today is House File 4746 from Chair Hassan. I will move House File 4746 be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Members, This bill is before us because of Section 1 of the bill, which relates to insurance. Our discussion today will be limited to Section 1 of the bill, which relates to insurance. I am instructing all members and all everybody in the room that that's what we're going to talk about today, are the insurance portions of the bill. And particularly for members who are going to, members of the public who are coming to testify today, your comments must relate to the insurance portion of the bill. We don't have time and we don't have jurisdiction to go into the other portions today. This bill is going to multiple other committee stops. Next, as you heard me say, the Judiciary Committee, but there are many after that, so you will have the opportunity to discuss those other issues in those other committees. I know there's other stakeholder groups working on this, and I know Chair Hassan is working very hard on it. So you will have the opportunity to address those issues, but today we are only talking about the insurance provisions. Representative Hassan, I see you have the A1 amendment. I will move the A1 amendment. I assume this gets the bill in the shape you'd like the committee to consider it.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Any discussion to the A1? Representative O'Driscoll.
We just do some background to save some time as to what the A1 does.
Sure. And I think that's fine, because this is the A1 is all of Section 1, which is the section on insurance. So why don't we do this? Representative Hassan, you can introduce your bill, and then we will vote on the A1 at that time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House File 4746 is the TNC bill, or Uber and Lyft bill. It's regulating the transportation network companies and providing fair pay and safe place, safe workplace for drivers. This bill has been introduced. This is the second time we're introducing. It was introduced last year, and it made it to the finish line, and it was vetoed by the governor, and we're coming back after working all summer with all stakeholders. There were, you know, folks who spent many months in their summer in a task force created by the governor, appointed by the governor, and leader Long was part of that task force. And this bill that's coming to you today is merely the recommendations from the task force. And we can talk about the insurance provisions, but I'll have, you know, our research, House research, just do a walkthrough of what the changes are on the amendment.
Ms. Bompu, if you could briefly describe the A1 amendment.
Surely. Chair and members, this is a new Section 1 added to the House file. This provision deals with auto insurance, and it adds a new type of insurance, a blanket accident and sickness policy that will cover drivers in situations where the auto insurance currently required under statute is not activated, in situations where there's a personal injury but the driver is not involved in an automobile accident that would otherwise trigger coverage. New definitions are provided. These are definitions of benefits that are provided under the blanket accident sickness policy. These are cross-references to current benefits provided under auto insurance, such as medical expense benefits, disability and income loss benefits, replacement service, survivor, economic, funeral, survivor replacement service loss benefits. A lot of clarifying changes are made regarding driver time periods, and this cross-references in with the rest of the bill so that we're using consistent terms for times when the driver is engaged in the app versus times when the driver is driving to pick up a passenger versus times when the driver is carrying a passenger, and what different insurance limits apply and types of insurance apply during those different times. I'm happy to answer any other questions about the amendment.
All right. Any further discussion to the A1? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails, and the A1 is adopted. Representative Hassan, you described the bill already, so now I think we will move into, unless you have anything further, we'll move to testimony on the bill.
That's fine with me.
All right. We will move to testimony on the bill. I just said this a second ago, but I just want to be very clear. We are talking about the insurance provisions. If you talk about something else, I'm going to interject, okay? So we're going to talk about the insurance provisions only. Today, our first testifier is Stephen Cooper. Mr. Cooper, if you could come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, the bill is absolutely essential. It is one that needs this portion, the insurance portion. There's only one thing I would say. The A1 weakens it significantly, And there's a number of things the original bill is originally written cover that the A1 takes away. What the A1 basically does is weaken the bill in a couple key places. It weakens the bill by not covering when the driver is not actually in a ride. So let me give you two examples, one out of San Francisco. A little girl, 3 years old, was run over after they got out of the car, not covered. Some of our clients have been shot and mugged after the ride was over, not covered. But having said that, I don't want to hesitate at all from this bill should pass. And for those who have any, I don't mean this bill, this part of the bill should pass. And for any of those who have any reluctance, let me assure you that this is the minimum that is absolutely essential to protect these drivers. So that would be my comment.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Cooper.
Thank you.
Next, we have Eid Ali. You just state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Eid Ali. I'm the president of Minnesota Uber and Lyft Drivers Association. I have been out here for the last 2 years advocating for the drivers and their well-being. And this specific part of this bill is one that is so dear to me because of I have been seeing so many drivers who were hurt during their work. So I was also a member of the task force, and I believe that some of the stuff that we have today in front of you are the recommendations that we made, and I fully support. And again, I'll just request from you to just kind of vote for this bill. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Next, we have Shoaib Mohammed. Come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Shoaib Mohammed. I'm from Minnesota Rideshare Drivers Association, and I'm the president of the organization. Actually, all Americans, we are under insurance, so there's no business that's run without insurance. We have a lot of incidents that happen while we are in driving for Uber and Lyft or TNC companies. So we are really requesting full insurance of $1 million. Insurance or sometimes over $2 million for liability insurance so that the driver have at least covered his vehicle, his life, and then, for example, if there's any other incident happen, should be covered. And also, we need the drivers are independent. They are not employee for TNC. We need at least concrete assurance so that the drivers being not an employee of the organization. They are all independent, and they must have general liability insurance to cover their incident if it happens. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Hassan, did you have one more person?
Yes, one more testifier. One more person. We'll be brief.
Yep. Sir, if you just want to come down and then state your name for the record and proceed to your testimony, welcome to the committee.
Hello, everyone. My name is Mohammed Yal. I'm from Mulda Members Organization, Drivers Advocate Group, and I'm here to support the bill that Representative Hodden and her co-authors brought up. I think it's a good bill. And one thing that I want to talk a little bit is about the insurance. I drive myself, and I pay like $2,400 a year for myself outside insurance, and Uber still is collecting another insurance. And if something happens to my car, I have to pay $2,500 deductible. So that's too much for the driver. So paying external insurance, Uber collecting also another $2,500, and then when something happens, you have to pay $2,500 deductible. That's too much. One thing that I would like also to talk about is the, the independence, independent contractor thing. I think that's a very tough issue nowadays to define what the driver, who the status of the driver, because that's something the labor, U.S. Labor Commission has to define. So it's very tough, but one thing I know is our flexibility. We're not fully employees. We're just workers. I don't know what rights we're gonna get from that, but we're not completely employees of Uber and Lyft. And that's all I'd like to add. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. That concludes testimony on the bill. We'll move to member discussion and questions to the bill. Discussion to the bill. Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, happy to see that we've got the insurance issue resolved here today, which is within the jurisdiction of the committee. And Chair Hassan, I hate to bring this up, but you still hold the record of the only veto that the governor has done since he's been in office. And
it's a badge of honor.
And I know that the bill still needs some work, and we may get to a point where I can support it, but again, today I'm recommending a no vote on it, and I wish you well as you continue to work on this, and I know that it's something that's been near and dear to your heart because you have not let up on it. So I wish you well and that we can get something that we can get some good bipartisan support on, but today I'm going to recommend my members with a no vote.
All right. With that, I'll give Chair Hassan a chance for closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for this wonderful discussion. I just want to highlight that these drivers that are here today, I want to thank them for their relentless efforts. This has been an ongoing battle, taking time off from their work, which requires them to be in their cars waiting for an app to tell them, go pick up somebody, but they're sitting here, and they have done that all year last year. I want to thank them for their efforts. I also want to thank all the community groups, advocates, commissioners, people who have worked on this bill during summer to make to bring us something that we are 90% in agreement with. You can't make everybody happy, but if you make majority of the people happy, then you should proceed. I also want to note that these are not, people who are driving this as a part-time gig. These are people who are working over 50, 60 hours a week to support their families. So with that said, this bill has many stops, like the chair said, and I am open to working with stakeholders to make sure that we have a bill that doesn't get vetoed. But I ask for your support.
Well, thank you, Chair Hassan, for bringing the bill, and thank you for your really tireless work on this bill. I know you've been working incredibly hard on it. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 4746 be re-referred, as amended, be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, and House File 4746, as amended, is recommended be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. And again, I'll ask people as they depart the room, feel free to do that. Just please be keep your conversations for the hallway. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. The next item on our agenda today, I'm just making sure the author's in the room, is House File 4717 from Representative Hemmingson Yeager. Representative Hemmingson Yeager, I will move House File 4717 be placed on the general register. And again, people, as you walk out, if you could keep your conversations until you're out of the committee room. Representative Hemmingson Yeager, to your bill.
Great, thank you. If I may just take a peek to make sure my testifiers made it up from downstairs.
Yeah.
Ta-da. Great.
All set.
Okay. All thank right. you. Well, good afternoon. Thank you for hearing this bill today. So I just kind of want to, as I was thinking about this bill, I remember doing my very first tax filing over the phone and writing checks in grocery stores. And then just thinking about how far we've come nowadays. So many of our accounts are online. You can tap your phone. You can tap your card. It's just really cool how technology has improved the movement of currency and money through our system. But I do want to emphasize that all of these transactions, they're regulated and they're backed by the federal government as a form of currency. So now enters virtual currencies and cryptocurrencies. These are a volatile, unbacked, decentralized, unregulated, and untraceable way of transferring money around the system. And this bill came up because of a discussion I had with my local police department, Woodbury Police Department, you can see them here, because they were noticing that our senior citizens were getting scammed in our city. They were happening at the locations where they're BTMs or Bitcoin-style ATMs, and there are 13 in Woodbury, which surprised me. It just seems like a lot. I know we're a big city, but that just seems like a lot. And because of this growing popularity, a lack of understanding, particularly among our seniors, it's allowed scammers to take advantage of just that. And these scams can result in losses upwards of tens of thousands of dollars. And once a transaction's complete, you can't get it back and you don't know where it went. So a little bit about this bill. It does not regulate virtual currency. Instead, it provides numerous consumer protections that would mitigate the damage that could be caused by these illegal scams. Highlights include definitions of virtual currencies and virtual currency kiosks, which is a broader definition for these VTMs. It prompts consents of purchase, and it has receipts just like any other ordinary ATM would have. Some particular points is it would have a grace period after the individual's first transaction. So it would allow somebody, say, if they were getting scammed, once they found out that they were a victim of a scam, they would have a certain time window to basically retract that and prevent anything illegal from happening. And then we are looking to at a way to cap the daily limit on these transactions, again, to protect our consumers. We want to make sure that these are being treated in any similar regulation that any other financial transaction would have. I do want to mention that I greatly appreciate the consultation of the Department of Commerce as well as the Attorney General's office. They've been very helpful in making sure that we can do this well and do it right. And I do want to recognize my Public Safety Director Jason Pozel here. I don't know if he'll have any words to say, but I do want to hand it over to my testifiers. So thank you.
All right, and I see we have two officers here. Are you Officer Linder, or are you Officer Ehrenberg?
Ehrenberg.
All right. Officer Ehrenberg, state your name for the record. Proceed to your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and representatives. My name is Tom Ehrenberg. I'm a police commander for the city of Woodbury, where I've worked for the last 17 years. I'm also joined by my police chief, Jason Pozel, and Officer Haley Linder, who has firsthand experience in taking reports from victims on this issue and is available to answer questions as well if needed. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today in support of Representative Hemmingson-Yeager's legislation that would provide more restrictions around cryptocurrency ATMs. This would ultimately put protections in place for residents throughout the state. In Woodbury, our department has been working on this issue for over the last 3 years when community members began alerting us of scams that were happening. We have typically seen older people being the target of these scams. Some of these victims are on a fixed income, and this money loss is very significant to paying for meals and housing. The scammers take advantage of them by making them feel confused and rushed to send funds to help a family member or pay an outstanding bill. As of now, we have focused our efforts on education and prevention. We have spoken to employees at businesses and put flyers up near the 15 machines in Woodbury. We have also conducted educational campaigns at senior living facilities and tried to bring awareness via social media. In spite of our best efforts, it still remains a prevalent issue in our community, as once the money is put into the machine, it is nearly impossible to get it back. There has been an estimated of $1.6 million of loss in our community alone in the last 3 years. And this is just from reported losses. Oftentimes, seniors who are scammed are embarrassed to report the situation, so the actual number of dollars likely is much larger. If there were limits on the amount that one can put into the machine, it would definitely help us, as we consistently see loss amounts well over $1,000. Many have been $10,000 to $20,000. And these are only the ones, again, that we know about. Creating a hold on time is also significant so that we have a chance to recover the funds when they realize it was a scam. As of now, the movement is very fast and does not give us a good chance or ability to help our victims. Thank you.
Thank you. And I heard you say that Officer Linder was here to answer questions, but does Officer Linder want to testify too, or are you just here for questions? Just here for questions. Great. The other testifier we have who signed up is Larry Lipka. Mr. Lipka, if you want to come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you for your time, Chair and honorable members of the committee. My name is Larry Lipka. I'm general counsel for CoinFlip, one of the Bitcoin ATM operators here in Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. CoinFlip opposes the bill as currently written, and we appreciate the opportunity to offer consumer protection-focused recommendations that we know to be highly effective in preventing fraudulent transactions at digital currency kiosks, another name for a Bitcoin ATM. CoinFlip is a money service business and registered with the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network and is subject to the Bank Secrecy Act and the United States Patriot Act. CoinFlip believes smart regulation is good for business and good for consumers. So we're not here saying don't regulate us, but we just want to make sure that we get some sort of smart regulation that protects consumers. Our recommendations are rooted in our experience as the largest kiosk operator in the U.S. and in the world. The following best practices further enhance consumer protections and should be considered as part of any legislation. First, requiring money transmitter licensing in the state of Minnesota. My company has about a dozen money transmitter licenses across the state, and that would allow the government to regulate us and to ensure we're acting properly. Second, require robust compliance. Third, require clear scam warnings at the kiosk prior to a transaction. Four, require blockchain analytics software to prevent fraud by automatically blocking customer transactions at high-risk digital wallets. CoinFlip has prevented hundreds of potentially fraudulent transactions from proceeding through this technology. And lastly, requiring live customer service. Unfortunately, as currently written, the bill does not prevent or address the root cause of scams and has unintended consequences. The proposed transaction limits do not consider federal suspicious activity or currency transaction reporting thresholds, which means less information will be reported to law enforcement. Moreover, any transaction limits should be limited to only first-time customers because those are the most vulnerable. In addition, while fees should be disclosed, a fee cap does not prevent fraud and does not consider the unique expenses involved in operating physical kiosks and moving cash. Lastly, the refund provision displays a misunderstanding of blockchain technology and creates an opportunity for scam artists to game the refund period and defraud kiosk operators. We look forward to working with members of this committee and the state legislator, and we have submitted a more detailed written testimony for the record. And while I'm here, I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Seeing none, member discussion and questions to the bill. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hemmings-Niagara, for taking on this topic. It is an important topic, and I think that this is directionally right. I like the direction this bill is going. I think it's important. I think that it's not quite ready yet. And one particular question I was I thought that the both of the industry letters were actually had a lot of I didn't agree with everything, especially in the markup on Rocket Coin. They had a kind of an interesting markup. Some of the points I thought were good. Some of the things they want to delete it, I think, probably are fine to have in there. But I was curious to hear maybe a little bit about your. We're sending this to the General Register. I think it still needs some work, and in particular. It uses the word virtual currency kiosk licensee, and I'm not sure that that's a term that actually means anything in Minnesota law right now. Do you have some intention to create a licensing scheme in an amendment or something like that after this committee, or what's your idea on how to get this bill across the finish line?
Representative Niska, can you just for me, can you point out where you're referring to when you talk about that term? Let Representative Hemmings-Niagara answer the question.
It's used repeatedly. So it starts, for example, in line 2.9, it refers to the virtual currency kiosk licensee must disclose, and it uses it in several places. And I don't know that we have any licensing scheme in Minnesota for virtual kiosk operators. Maybe we should, and if you know we want to work on that. I think maybe that's good. But just curious as to sort of what your thoughts are on how to get this bill across the finish line.
Representative Hemmings-Niagara.
Great. Yeah, thank you. Appreciate your comments. I will say that we just got this feedback from the industry maybe like a day or two ago. As you can see, it was very comprehensive. I do appreciate all of their feedback. I was taking notes as he was testifying as well. So the intention is to do a thorough like side by side and make sure. I think there are some things, particularly the transaction limit. Right now we have $2,500. If it's going to be $3,000 so that we can flag it more with the federal IRS or anything, I'm definitely open to that. But I just want to make sure that, again, the goal of this is consumer protection and making sure that our seniors are not getting scammed out of money.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hemmings-Niagara. One other concern in terms of the transaction limits is we don't want to be in a position where we're actually sort of like requiring structuring of transactions, which is a pretty big problem from, when you're talking about federal bank secrecy laws and things like that. I just want to say, as a final comment, I'd be happy to work with you on this, see if we can get this in the shape of something where I could support it. I do, in my other job, have done a little bit of crypto security related stuff. So I'm not an expert, but I know enough to be dangerous and maybe help a little bit. So, I think this is, like I said, I think this is directionally right as long as we can write it in a way that actually works, and I appreciate your work on it.
Representative Farr.
Thank you, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hemmingson Yeager. So I appreciate the bill because if you all know what I do for a living, and if I had a dollar for every time I've dealt with this, I could take you all out to dinner. And I also appreciate the law enforcement members and all the time that you put into this because, again, I've dealt with this personally with customers. Would love to Representative Niska's comments. I'd love to help you out with this. But one of the questions I had as I read through this and just functionally, how do we do this? How do we have that 72-hour currency transaction that we can back out of that transaction? The money's in, the ATM, the Bitcoin ATM. So the money's still there, but that ATM has already created the transaction and it's gone somewhere. So are we now, is the person that owns that ATM held short or shorted that? I'm just not sure how we're able to do that.
Representative Hemmingson Yeager.
Yeah, so not knowing the engineering or anything of these kiosks, I can speculate that there's probably some sort of like software or programming that can be done. I would love to take that question and get back to you. I don't think I have a phone a friend who knows the intimate details of how the kiosks work.
Okay. I'm sure you and Representative Farr can work together offline about that.
But yeah, no, I'd love to do that because I think that money is gone, and the last thing we're trying to do is stick someone else with the, holding the bill, and so I would love to have that conversation and just make sure that we're not creating another problem.
Yeah.
Chair. Representative Hemmingson Yeager.
Yeah, just. So it's all out there. My intention is that nobody would be out the money. It would exactly. be, again, because this is a virtual kind of thing, it would, the transaction would not even be released until that waiting period was done, would be kind of my intention. So I don't want anybody holding the bag.
Yep. No, under,
where's it far?
Mr. Chair, I understood and appreciate that. I don't, it's not the way I think it's working right now. And so I don't know that we've got the ability to change that. So I'd just like to maybe run that to ground and make sure that we're doing what we want to do.
Great.
Thank you.
Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hemmingson Yeager, thank you for the bill. Since I'm doing a legislative task force on aging, I've learned a lot about pre-dementia, early dementia, where people appear to be quite competent but are losing the capability to discern what is fraudulent and what is not. So as you're going forward with this, I would just ask you to kind of keep that in mind and think about as we're thinking about these policies to look at best practices for that growing population in our state. Thank you.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do like the idea of what we're going for, where you're heading with us. As Representative Farr, who is in the banking industry, and he has probably the most knowledge of this stuff, other than the law enforcement people in the room who have dealt with this in many situations. But with a credit card, with a bank account, there are safety nets. And quite honestly, it's going to have to be something that the federal government is going to have to do because of the interstate commerce relationship on these kinds of things. But I do like the fact that we're doing some educating and putting something in front of people that says, just, buyer beware here a little bit about what's going on. This isn't your father's ATM, if you will, because your father might not use an ATM for all we know, right? But the idea that we're trying to do something to help inform consumers, I think, is worthwhile.
All right. Before closing comments, I just want to thank Representative Hemmingson Yeager for bringing this bill. I think it's an emerging issue that I'm really glad you tackled, and I think there seems to be broad consensus on the committee that something needs to happen on this, and I appreciate your willingness to work with everybody. We are going to have an omnibus bill coming out of the Commerce Committee in the next couple weeks, and I would love to include language to this, so I, hopefully can continue working with folks to address those issues. I know we're sending the plan is to send this bill out of committee today, but I know that you'll keep working on it, and then we'll look to try and include it in an omnibus bill. Closing comments, Representative Hemmingson Yeager.
Great. Thank you. I really appreciate all the comments. I
I'm a scientist, so I love getting my data to cover all variables to really make this robust and implementable and really reach the goals that we want it to reach. I would like to draw your attention to the written testimony that was here from actually one of my detective's mom. Yeah. It details like her experience basically stopping this from happening. She was observing some things and she was able to stop this fraud in its tracks. And this is what is really cool, and I really appreciate the collaboration with our police department because we were able to come together and think about how can we address this. Big thanks to Senator McEwen's office too. We had two bills kind of doing the same thing, and we decided to join forces and work together. So really excited about that. And then I would like to thank my legislative assistant, Alex Wheeler. He has done a ton of help kind of sifting through, organizing thoughts, researching. He actually called all 13 locations over the summer to try to understand how these are even coming into our community. We didn't get many responses, but that research is very appreciated. So like I said, I will continue to work on this. I appreciate the collaboration, appreciate the feedback, and looking forward to having a really great bipartisan bill coming up.
No, thank you. We really do have excellent staff here at the Minnesota House of Representatives. I will renew my motion that House File 4717 be placed on the general register. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say no. The motion prevails. House File 4717 is recommended to be placed on the general register. Next item on the agenda is House File 4853 from Representative Bierman. And when Representative Bierman is settled at the front, he can make a motion.
Very good, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 4853 before the committee today.
Representative Bierman moves House File 4853 be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee, and you have the A1 amendment.
Yes, I have the A1, and I'd like to move the A1, please.
All right. The A1 gets the bill in the shape you'd like to, the committee to consider it. Is that correct?
That is correct. Thank you.
All right. So Representative Bierman moves the A1. Discussion to the A1. Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The A1 is adopted. Representative Bierman, to your bill is amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members. All of us have helped support nonprofit health maintenance organizations for decades. HMOs were invented in Minnesota in 1973. The pledge of the nonprofit HMOs has always been to exist as a charitable organization for the healthcare benefit of Minnesotans. These entities and how we regulate them in a complex and evolving healthcare marketplace have clear financial implications for our citizens. An HMO conversion is the transfer of all or a substantial portion of a nonprofit health maintenance organization business or assets to a for-profit entity. This most commonly happens when a nonprofit is purchased by a for-profit entity. Members, conversions in other states unprepared for such transitions saw charitable assets removed from public benefit after years of public investment, making millions of dollars for executives and nothing for the states. A strengthening of the rules and regulations pertaining to conversions are needed in this state to avoid this public asset loss that has occurred in other states. This bill creates robust safeguards around conversions for the public interest, including a transparent public process, a full and fair market value assessment of the public benefit assets to be preserved for the public good, and the bill assigns the Attorney General as the current protector of charitable assets in Minnesota presently to ensure that these public assets from conversions are utilized as designated to advance the future health care interests of Minnesotans. The Minnesota Department of Health is the regulator of Minnesota's HMOs, but they receive far less information and oversight than the Department of Commerce has over health insurers. This bill updates the sight lines of MDH to regulate both nonprofit and the new for-profit HMOs allowed to operate in the state. This is the first hearing on this legislation. Conversations will surely continue, but I've had consultations with MDH, Commerce, and the AG's office on the way, They've been integral to this work. I believe they are here today if we would need them. But, Mr. Chair, I'm ready to move to testifiers, please, and then we can go to questions.
Wonderful. We do have a number of testifiers who signed up. Reminder that we're going to have to limit everyone to 2 minutes today. Our first testifier is Robert Hader. Mr. Hader, come forward, say your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Stevenson and members of the committee, my name is Robert Hader, and I'm the legislative director at Take Action Minnesota. We are a grassroots multiracial people's organization that believes in a democracy and government that works for us all. For over 15 years, Take Action has worked to promote a people-centered healthcare system. I'm here today to share our strong support of House File 4853. We have an opportunity here to learn from experiences in other states, many of whom did not pass conversion regulations until many public benefit assets had already been stripped in the name of corporate greed. In California, a $3 billion transfer of public assets to two foundations came about after Blue Cross initially offered to donate only $100 million to charity. Thanks to strong conversion regulations, they ensure that all of those assets remained a public benefit. Because of a conversion protection in Maryland, the insurance commissioner there was able to review the transaction when WellPoint tried to buy CareFirst and hold public hearings around the state. There they uncovered that $75 million was set to go to corporate executives. That conversion was found to be not in the public interest and it was denied. In Ohio, a controversial conversion proposal from one nonprofit inspired conversion legislation that was employed in a subsequent merger between a nonprofit and Anthem. But the review of the merger was not open to the public, only $28 million in assets were protected, and the board of the new foundation included the for-profit insurer. A lot is at stake here in Minnesota in getting this right. These examples point to the importance of four things, all of which this bill does well. One, the Attorney General has the opportunity to review conversions, gather independent assessment of value, and protect public assets for the public interest. Two, the public has the opportunity to have input into these decisions. Three, the governance of the resulting conversion benefit entity is independent and responsive to community needs. And fourth, the Department of Health is notified of a broader set of transactions so that they can analyze trends and be alert to emerging concerns and gaps in regulation. We urge you all to support the regulations and consumer protections authorized in this bill to ensure that public assets are used for public good and not converted into corporate profits. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Justin Stofferin.
Excuse me. Thank you, Chair Stevenson and committee members. My name is Justin Stofferon with the Minnesota Farmers Union, which is a grassroots organization that's represented family farmers, ranchers, and rural communities for over 100 years. And I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of House File 4853. As you heard from Mr. Sanders earlier, this past November at our annual convention, MFU members voted to make ensuring affordable and accessible care in rural Minnesota a top priority for our organization. And this legislation is one component of meeting that goal. This bill will help ensure that the significant public investment that Minnesota taxpayers have made in nonprofit health plans remains available for the public's benefit and not used for private gain. Our members have prioritized health care issues because farmers in rural communities face significant challenges getting the health care they need and deserve, something you already heard from Mr. Sanders. The language in this bill might be a little complex and wonky, and I know Representative Bierman has worked tirelessly on getting it right, but the basic principle is pretty simple. We should either keep the public assets that have been built up over time in nonprofit health plans, or those assets should be used to fund public health care initiatives. Our organization has also been working to address consolidation in our health care system, which has had a massive impact on health care access in rural communities. And without a strong regulatory framework in Minnesota for these transactions, as you heard in the previous testimony, we fear that after lifting the moratorium in 2026, it could spur acquisitions and further consolidation that will leave farmers and rural communities with even less access to the care they need. I'd urge the committee to support this bill. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and thank you again to Representative Bierman for his leadership on this issue.
Thank you. And last, we have Dan Andreessen. Mr. Andreessen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. The council is still reviewing the language that's in the bill and the amendment, and we're committed to working with Representative Bierman as this bill moves along. However, the council does contend that this bill is premature. Last session, language was passed instructing the Department of Health to study and develop recommendations on the regulation of conversions, mergers, transfers of assets, and other transactions of both nonprofit and for-profit HFOs. The preliminary report was released on January 15th, and the final report is not going to be coming out until June 30th. Also, what was mentioned, there is currently a moratorium on in statute on any conversion transactions, so we don't think there's any immediate need to move new regulations. The moratorium was first enacted in 2017 after the requirement was removed in statute that all HMOs must be, in the fully insured market, must be nonprofit. This conversion moratorium was reauthorized in 2019 and again last session until 2026. The council suggests that before the legislature enact significant new regulations and oversight, that you wait to find out what the findings of the study will be. Lastly, one of the arguments that are being made is for this new regulations out concern that a nonprofit HMO would convert to be a for-profit. If that is a concern, rather than create new regulations, you could also revisit the topic of licensing HMOs in Minnesota and reenacting the nonprofit HMO requirement. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We'll now move to member discussion and questions to the bill. Discussion to the bill. Seeing no discussion, Representative Bierman, closing comments.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and members, for hearing the bill today. I appreciate that. And as this moves forward, I would appreciate any input that you care to offer. And thanks to the committee.
Thank you. I will, Representative Bierman renews his motion that House File 4853, as amended, be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, and House File 4853, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. The last item on our agenda today is House File 3320 from Representative Kraft, and I will let Representative Kraft make his motion when he gets to the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 3320 be referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law.
Representative Kraft moves that House File 3320 be recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Policy Committee. Representative Kraft, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, this bill is a result of a constituent of mine, Jim Nicholson, reaching out to me over a year ago and telling me about this issue. As I dug into it and learned more from him, from providers of boat shrink wrap services, it's on boat shrink wrap plastic, from marinas, from waste management companies, from county waste organizations and from other states, I became absolutely appalled at the volume of plastic waste we're generating from boat shrink wrap plastic. Minnesota has the most boats per capita of any U.S. state, and in fact, the second most boats, period, of any state, well over 800,000. Many of these boats get shrink wrapped in the winter to protect them from the elements. Based on surveys done in other states about the percent of boats that are shrink-wrapped and the average amount of shrink-wrap used per boat, which is between 15 and 40 pounds, it's likely there's at least 6 million pounds of boat shrink-wrap used every year in Minnesota, the vast majority of which goes into a landfill or incinerator. But this plastic can be recycled. From a company in Michigan that does it, quote, it is number four LDPE, low-density polyethylene plastic, which is one of the most common plastic materials available, and it's also easily recycled into things like plastic lumber, construction sheeting, and garbage bags, end quote. By the way, there's also some work on being able to recycle it into film again. So this is a product stewardship bill that requires producers of shrink wrap to fund a product stewardship organization that collects and recycles the boat plastic across Minnesota. The best and most cost-effective time to think about how to recycle something is upfront when you're creating, packaging, and selling the product. The program will be administered by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and was modeled after the successful paint product stewardship program from several years ago. From a cost perspective, shrink wrapping a boat, you know, give or take, costs about $400. So we can have just a frame of reference. In Michigan, as I said, there's a company that collects and recycles boat shrink wrap for $9 per boat. So with that, I believe I have one testifier.
Yes. We have Ivana Stark signed up. Come forward, state your name for the record. Proceed to your testimony. Welcome back to the committee.
Chair Stevenson and members of the committee, I'm Ivana Stark, State Director of Clean Water Action. I represent our 132,000 members regarding issues that keep our water safe to drink, cook with, and play in. As a boat owner myself, I take responsibility for the ownership very seriously, and recently our canvas cover ripped, and it was not cheap. Our quote was around $2,500 for a new cover. My fiance suggested plastic wrap because that was about $300 for our boat, and you can imagine how well that conversation went for him in our house. Not well. Minnesota leads the nation in boats per capita with roughly 14,500 boats per 100,000 people. The one pager in your packet gives you a lot of stats, so let's focus on the fact that a moderate estimate of 6.25 million pounds of shrink wrap a year is used, and that ends up in our landfills. And many of you have heard me say over and over that 98 out of our 101 landfills are leaching chemicals into the groundwater. As you've heard, this bill creates a product stewardship system and plan to responsibly mechanically recycle this boat wrap and turn it back into boat wrap. It creates jobs in Minnesota, and it keeps toxic chemicals that are plastic in our plastic out of our landfills and out of our water. This prevents pollution and it saves money. We feel that the producers of waste must be responsible for it throughout its life cycle, and this is the right first step to take. As a boat owner, I'm excited to engage in a process that reduces waste and protects our water. The cost to boat owners is extremely low and well worth it when you consider the return on investment. For less than the cost of a large bottle of non-toxic sunscreen, one boat worth of plastic is recycled. Make sure your sunscreen's non-toxic. I urge your support of this bill and sincerely thank Representative Kraft for supporting our waterways through this bill. Thank you.
I'll throw one more option on the table, which is a tarp and some bungee cords. That's what I do. I don't
that's
know if
actually
that's
what we ended up doing.
An Anoka County solution to the problem, but that's no duct tape involved. Discussion to the bill. Representative Driscoll.
To the bill author, he had indicated that he had done some research, and the chair offered an alternative. I'm just wondering if the bill author has an alternative that he can offer to the shrink wrap so that it wouldn't have to be recycled.
Representative Kraft.
Mr. Chair, no fair taking your answer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Driscoll, there are also long-term solutions that last about 10 years or so. They cost maybe eight times what the $400 average is. So there are other solutions. This bill is not weighing in on the efficacy of one over the other. It's just saying we got this problem, we should, and there's something we can do about it. We should do something about it.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, closing comments, Representative Kraft.
As you heard, we go through millions of pounds of boat shrink wrap plastic every year. We can do something else with it than have it go to our landfills and incinerators. Please support the bill.
All right. And with that, Representative Kraft renews his motion that House File 5320 be recommended to be referred to the Judiciary Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Oppose. Motion prevails, and House File 3320 is recommended to be referred to the Judiciary Finance and Policy Committee. Representative O'Driscoll.
Just an observation. You really know how to clear a room, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. We try. All right. That concludes our agenda for today. The meeting is adjourned.